Looking for the best place to buy tickets for any of your favorite teams or sporting events? We've got the spot. Our partner, StubHub, has been the leading ticket marketplace in the world for over 20 years, providing a 100% guarantee with every order. From a worldwide selection of live events, the widest choice of tickets and industry-leading partnerships, StubHub has what you need to purchase with confidence. StubHub, an official partner of The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine and I'm joined now by Alex Stewart.
Yes, you are, Joe. Yes, you are.
Ah, guten Tag, Herr Seb Stafford-Bloor.
Hello, Joe.
Yes, okay. Hello. And today we'll be talking about the Champions League, mostly. We've got some Tuchel on the menu, bit of Chelsea Atletico Madrid. We've also got some Guardiola bites as a side for their defeat over to, not to, the way they beat Borussia Mönchengladbach, that's right. We've got some the breadsticks of Madrid to discuss, and also Premier League relegation as a pud. Tiramisu, yes please. And other than that, we also head over to the continent for a couple of updates on other things and have a great chat. There's also Joe's player quotes and facts database. It's a jam-packed menu today. Every meal has jam in it, and I hope you enjoy listening to it. So thanks a bunch for downloading. Let me tell you also, while you're here, that if you'd like to, you can get even more jam than I've mentioned by going to theathletic.com/TIFO and signing up to a special deal of just £1 per week to read everything that The Athletic has to offer. And I tell you what, gang, that's a lot of jam, okay? And it's real high-quality jam, not the kind of jam that you would buy for 99p at a supermarket, but the kind that if you were to visit the countryside and you were to see, a friendly-looking middle-aged couple stood at the side of the road with a small trestle table and homemade jam full of almost full bits of fruit in it, yeah, but no pip, that's the kind of jam I'm talking about. So if you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you can avail yourselves of that jam for just £1 per week. Just to clarify, it's not jam, it's high-quality football journalism, and it always will be. So you won't actually get any jam, but the metaphor, you understand. Anyway, so there we go. I will leave you now in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Thomas Tuchel. Okay, let us begin with Chelsea 2, AG 3, nil AG nil, Atletico Madrid. Tuchel, by the way, we can talk about Thomas Tuchel now, because Thomas Tuchel, did you know, has coached Chelsea for 13 games, during which they have conceded only twice on two separate occasions. That's 9 wins, 4 draws, 15 goals, remaining undefeated. This feels starkly different to Lampard's time, Seb. Is this the difference of an elite coach, or is it just too soon to be such a bastard to Frank Lampard?
No, I think so, because I think the prevailing narrative around Lampard was that he had a group of players that he couldn't coach, so a group of players that sort of were unmovable, particularly in defence. And obviously, as you said, 13 games later, all of a sudden, people are starting to talk about Chelsea as maybe being contender for the European Cup. Bit different. And hey, you know what? Since we're talking about keeping clean sheets and defending, look at the improvement in some of those defenders. Cesar Azpilicueta, for instance, or Andreas Christensen. Look how much better Antonio Rudiger has been.
He was so great last night.
He's great. He does a lot of things really well, and not just in defence, not just without the ball. He's a good footballer.
True.
Bit of
a shit smothers, house, doesn't he? He's a real smotherer.
I'm not going to get derailed by that. He is a shithouse. He has a little bit of previous in getting opponents sent off. And he did it again last night. Well done.
Sure. I have to say, I really... I know you're not supposed to like this stuff as a supporter of football, but when he patted the... I'm not sure, I can't remember which Atletico Madrid player it was, but the one complaining at him for falling as hard as he did when the elbow was thrust at him, all you know, fairly softly, when he patted that chap on the back of the head and just smiled in his face.
Yeah.
I thought, oh man, you've got to be an asshole to do that. Like, that's a special kind of dick move. You know, at least be ashamed of yourself. But no, you know, why not? He got elbowed in the chest. It certainly was a red card action. Whether it was of a red card ferocity or not, I suppose is the debating point.
Yeah, he kind of makes sure the red card is given and that the incident is spotted, I suppose.
Do you know what? As any other player on the pitch would do, right? I think when it comes to defenders, particularly big, tall defenders, suddenly our barometer seems slightly different. And I don't know that somebody who is big and tall being elbowed in the chest is any different to anybody, any adult being elbowed in the chest. Isn't that fair?
I can honestly say I don't think I've ever been elbowed in the chest.
Have you not? Didn't you go to school?
Yeah, but I got elbowed in the forehead and in the rib.
What?
Well, no, playing football, but never in the chest.
Well, that's because it was Savage, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Because he did it on purpose. It wasn't by accident, was it? It wasn't an accident. He jabbed. He knew what he was doing. I think that's the other thing. He didn't do it particularly hard. Anyway, goodness me, we're caught on a controversial decision. That's very unlike the TIFO football podcast. Can I say, Alex, I know you're a fan of Declan Rice, but for some Chelsea supporters, Declan Rice has become a sort of symbol of the Lampard era in a way that I think maybe perhaps a more real one is Ben Chilwell, who hasn't really been playing very much recently. It seems like, as Seb was saying, you know, there was this group of players that Lampard struggled to coach, and he wanted to bring Declan Rice in for 40 or 50 or 60 million pounds, depending on which rumour you hear. And then last night you watched the performance of Chelsea's midfield, and particularly Kante in that defensive midfielder role, who was just exceptional as usual, as expected, I suppose. And you start to wonder, what was Lampard doing?
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? I mean, there was some talk about Lampard wanting Rice in as a centre-back as well to give them more controlled passing from the back. But again, Christensen has done that reasonably well in the absence of Thiago Silva. He wasn't playing yesterday. But, you know, Tuchel has solved a lot of these problems. He's given Chelsea a much greater degree of defensive solidity, which can make them look a little more ponderous in attack. But this ability to hog the ball, to shift from side to side in a block, the ability of Kovacic, Kante or Jorginho, whoever's playing in that midfield too, to kind of cover the back three, but also then get the ball forwards in transition. I think Chelsea are much, much better in transition now than they were before. And that's both attack into defence and vice versa. And that's a lot to do with organisation. And I think if you look at, for example, the change in Rudiger, I mean, you know, Rudiger was not great under Lampard. There was some discussion on Twitter yesterday about, you know, the fact that he hadn't necessarily been great under Sarri or Conte either. But what Tuchel has done is identified what he's good at and what he's not so good at. And playing as a wider centre-back in a three, where he can carry the ball forwards, where he can use his pace, but where he's got sufficient cover by being in a back three, clearly plays to his strengths and gets the best out of him. And I think what Tuchel's done is he's very quickly identified a way of making Chelsea much, much more difficult to get around in transition, building from that base principle of let's not concede goals, let's keep things tight. And then he's, you know, starting to get more of a tune out of his attacking players.
Yeah, because it's hardly a sort of defensive lineup that you would expect to have gone, you know, this many minutes without conceding a goal. I mean, I think, you know, there's been Zouma and Christensen are two players who have had potential for a long time, but, you know, remain within Chelsea's team, or certainly within the wider perspective, to be still young players with some potential, right? However young they actually are. You've talked about Rudiger there. Also, Azpilicueta, a natural right back, has been playing on the right-hand side of this three as well. And even Christensen was, as you say, unavailable last night, and Zouma stepped in his place. There must be more going on within the team, right? Because it just seemed last night that Atletico Madrid were never going to score. And when you read the players' names individually, you sort of wonder how this has happened. But systematically, I guess it's working.
I think that's absolutely right. And it does, in my opinion, it starts with that midfield pivot and its ability to shift across, compact the space and keep that back line protected. I mean, I thought the only time that Chelsea looked at all vulnerable yesterday was when they were trying to play out from the back. They did manage to get that kind of ball out to the left and then a progressive pass into midfield that allowed them to then hoover up the second ball. That was kind of their out and it worked quite well. Mendy is not massively convincing with the ball at his feet. And Chelsea did look to invite a bit of pressure. But again, the fact that they continue to do that, despite the fact they nearly got caught out a couple of times, does indicate a real confidence in that unit, that these players know where each other are going to be. They have confidence in the players alongside them. The rotation, like you say, bringing Zouma into the centre, who's a very good aerial presence, not necessarily a great kind of ball-playing defender. It's working very well, and it's very, very difficult, even if you're being relatively kind, it's very difficult to see that this isn't just what happens when you have a much better coach in charge.
Well, towards the other end of the pitch now, I want to ask you about Kai Havertz, who's started the last four games, three of which he played at in the centre-forward role, really. Last night against Atletico Madrid, he played in that left-sided, inside-forward role, a bit like the Mason Mount area. Mason Mount, of course, unavailable for last night's game too. Tuchel has said of him in a press conference, I think before the Leeds game, that in my opinion, his best position is between the 9 and the 10 and have the freedom to drop and move fluid between the two positions. So he has only scored once so far this year, which was under Lampard, but he played an important role in the first goal against Atletico last night. And Alex, at the time you mentioned that it looked to you like Havertz at Leverkusen. Do you think that his future is in that position too? I mean, Germany certainly need a striker, so it could be good.
Yeah, they do. I think the problem that Chelsea have at the moment is that the constituent parts of that attack are all very good, but they're not quite gelling yet. And I think Havertz definitely is what Tuchel says he is. He's very, very good at dropping off. He's very good at linking play. With that first goal last night, he took the ball under pressure and used his strength and his speed to push forwards before releasing a good pass. And that's the kind of stuff when it's broken play and he can charge forwards. That's what he's really good at, late arriving in the box, that kind of stuff. Unfortunately, I think what that requires is to have wide players, and this is one of the things that he did well at Leverkusen when playing in that role, was he had players like Moussa Diaby who were able to cut inside ahead of him. And that's with Chelsea using wing-backs, and if Ziyech is in the right-hand slot, that's not going to happen so much. So where he's drifting off and playing sometimes behind Werner, but sometimes alongside him, and Chelsea do this thing where they have two attacking midfielders and then a striker, but actually one of the attacking midfielders tends to kind of tuck inside and form like a 1-2 shape, and the other one pushes up, and usually Mason Mount's doing that from the left, but here Ziyech was doing it from the right. I think that works really well, because then Havertz can play between the lines. He can get ahead of the other striker. He can drop really deep and carry the ball, but you've still got that focal point in Timo Werner last night, which gives Chelsea something to aim for. So I don't know if he'll work as a false nine on his own unless Chelsea start getting wide attacking players that are able to cut inside. And obviously that's slightly harder with the wing back thing anyway, because then that leaves a bit of a gap in the sort of 10 position. So there's still stuff to work out, but it looks again like Tuchel's priority was to stop them conceding and to get them much, much better in transition. And now he's working out exactly how to fine tune that attack and how to get the best out of everyone.
Yeah. Okay. Seb, Reece James, I thought he was great against Atletico Madrid. I thought he was really industrious. I liked how he cut inside quite a lot too. He seems to, you know, the ball seems to stick to him, or at least he always seems to find a way through a congested area, even if it looks a little bit haphazard at times. If he's only 21 years old too, what does his future look like?
Well, I expect him to be the long-term challenger to Trent Alexander-Arnold for England's right-back spot. I think in this instance, he might be a beneficiary of some of the things happening inside him. both in the centre of defence, but also in midfield. Because I thought that
when you said inside him, I thought you meant
like emotionally
in his body, emotionally, or yeah, in his mind.
You know, he's reached a nice personal equilibrium. You know,
we're all beneficiaries of the things happening inside of us,
certain,
aren't we?
For certain. But if you look at the other things going on at Chelsea, so obviously we've talked about central defence, but I thought one of the standouts on Wednesday night was N'Golo Kante's performance. These things help a fullback because it takes away their responsibilities. It takes away like some of the dysfunction happening in their peripheral vision. And we know that Reece James is a good footballer. We know he's we know about his quality delivering from wide. I liken him to, and most fullbacks, to be fair, we're all wingbacks. I liken them to the castle on the chessboard. Like, uh-huh. If you give them a kind of a fairly, yeah, rook, castle. If you give them a fairly narrow place to operate within, like, they could be at the most effective. If you start saying to them, right, well, you're also going to have to start covering for this underperforming centre half inside you and the big muddle of a midfield that we kind of haven't decided on, and we're going to try this player here and that one up here, and you start complicating it, you start taking away from things like good delivery and recovery and, you know, ability to come inside. I think, like...
Sure, that's the bishop's job.
I've been derailed. I've been hijacked.
Well, also, with this point, and I agree with what you're saying, Seb, the queen, perhaps, in this instance, is Azpilicueta, because Azpilicueta played on the right side of a back three under Conte, so he's used to it. But obviously he came to the club and has also regularly played as a right back.
So it gives
Reece James a lot of security, knowing that the centre-back who's playing inside and behind him is able to cover across with complete freedom of movement, much like a player on the chessboard who can go in any direction for any kind of length.
No, I think you've broken the analogy here.
There is a good point in there, though, with Azpilicueta, because I think that, yes, he played for a long time as a fullback, but he also played for a long time as a left-back as well. And I think it's always beneficial when you put a player like that into your back line, you kind of, you're importing wisdom, if that makes sense. Like, obviously, natural experience, he's been a very successful player for a long time, but he understands the obligations of a fullback on both sides. He understands what he would want from a centre-half in those situations. And I think those things are very, very difficult to measure, but they're definitely of benefit to a fullback, and especially a young one.
So who's the king?
I'm not sure, but who's the pawn that gets to the other side? You know, that one. I was going to ask you one other question about Chelsea, and it was, to say, do you know how Kante's really good at defensive midfield? Yeah. And then obviously people want to do different things, and so sometimes that means, for example, under Sarri, you know, I've brought Jorginho, and that's where he plays. So we'll have to find a new place for Kante, or with Lampard, who did to be fair to him, play Kante at the DM more often, but also in that sort of right hand side shuttling position too. Isn't it fair to say, right, that when your best player performs best in a particular position, that either the club shouldn't hire managers that don't want to play him there, or they should sell him and get a different one? Because I think Kante is their best player.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. But then I don't think that anybody at Chelsea would fight you in saying that the Sarri era was just a big mistake from everyone involved and involved a lot.
Sure. I guess the point, that's not really I'm not going, surprise, it was wrong. What I'm saying is that Kante is Chelsea's best player, I think, and I think is still undervalued. Because of the position that he plays and because the contribution that he makes is sometimes difficult to see, or just naturally difficult as a result of his role, the perception is always going to be that, you know, the best player for a team is usually an attacking player, and that's the most important. And but I mean, I look at this Chelsea team and it's stacked with fantastically talented people, but I think Kante is the best player by far.
Can I venture a contrarian perspective on this?
I was hoping that you would.
Lovely. So when we talk about N'Golo Kante, and specifically in reference to Maurizio Sarri, everyone says, oh, you know, like, he's best as a defensive midfielder, and you start messing about with the position and you're going to create difficulties in your midfield. Like, I've got a certain amount of sympathy for anyone who wishes to alter his position, because he's superb as a defensive midfielder. But anybody saying that that is the limit of his contribution is obviously wrong. He's a very, very rounded player who, with a little bit more shooting ability and a bit more composure in the other box, could be a brilliant number eight in a different era, perhaps. In this situation, there must be an awful temptation, a huge temptation to say, I've got this player who can do this one department of the game to really, really high standard. What else can I do with him, given that we're seeing he's a big asset in counter-attacking play? Look back on his contributions in Leicester's title-winning season. But what can I do by moving him into different areas of pitch? Can I create a, when we're attacking, can I create a lock on our, you know, on a kind of territorial advantage, if that makes sense? So when you're attacking the kind of the front third of the pitch, can you prevent a can you prevent an opposition from breaking forward on you? Can you seal that bit of the pitch off? Can you use Kante to do that? Like, when you have someone that's that talented, of course you're gonna, your mind's gonna wander a little bit. Does that make sense?
No, I don't like it. I think I like to go, you're great at this, and you're going to do this forever.
Yeah, but
and that's,
okay, but
that's
so,
it, because it proves my point.
Okay, no, but if you apply the same logic to great players in history, so I don't know, Thierry Henry, for instance, started life as a winger. If someone at some point in his career doesn't think, I wonder what he could do if dot dot dot.
No, see, I think he should have stayed as a winger. I think that's, I think basically that's.
Hey, Leo Messi. You know, Leo Messi probably becomes you know, the greatest player in history. Regardless, but without Guardiola thinking, I wonder what happens if I offset him from the forward line a little bit and get those Real Madrid defenders chasing forward. Like, these are little, these are little quantum leaps that you make, and they
lead
to great
things. Change.
You
don't
want
to
change that.
Anything to change.
You want everything to be the same forever. Yeah.
Joao Felix was described by the commentary team again. I keep saying last night, but of course this is probably Wednesday. Well, no, it definitely is Wednesday. It was described by Wednesday's commentary team as looking a little bit lost during the game, which I don't think was unfair. But I was this is the first time that I've these two games are the first time that I've watched Atletico Madrid all season. So this is my first time of seeing Joao Felix this season. And so I was reading about him after the game, because all I really know about him is that there was this huge, great, big, enormous transfer fee. And I found Sid Lowe writing about him on ESPN during the first half of the season, who said at the time that he was probably the best player in Spain. 10 goals, 6 assists so far this season, still only 21 years old. You know, is he still on course to live up to that huge transfer fee, Seb, given that I have only watched him twice and he wasn't fantastic either time?
Oh yeah, he's absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's I don't even think of him as a goals and assists type player. He's just, he represents the fun in the game and the artistry. He's just absolutely brilliant. Last couple of games, maybe you've caught him at a bad time. Like,
this is why I wanted to ask, because I figured like it's possible a lot of people will have, like, if people who don't watch La Liga like myself. I don't think I watched that Atletico earlier in the Champions League. This is literally the only two times I've seen him play, and I can't remember him from the first leg. So this is why I ask, to be reassured that there is some good in the world.
So I watched Atletico's draw with Getafe at the weekend, as you know, because I had that big moan about time wasting, didn't I?
Right. Yes, you did.
Kind of lost my mind a little bit, yeah. Well, one of the problems there was that, and I think if I'm thinking of the right article, I think this was something that Sid Lowe mentioned in that piece for ESPN, which is that one of the ways in which Simeone has used Luis Suarez since he arrived from Barcelona is as a kind of reference point for Joao Felix on the pitch. So, like, what are Suarez's abilities at this stage of his career? Well, he's not as quick as he was, but he still attracts a lot of defensive attention. He still occupies centre backs, he creates space elsewhere for other players who can sit in pockets of space. So Joao Felix is obviously a really good example of that. And against Getafe, who were pretty stubborn defensively, that didn't really happen. And that's coincided with a few weeks where I don't know if this is premature or unfair, but Luis Suarez has started to look a bit tired. He started to look his age. And I saw someone on Twitter say, whilst last night's game was happening, shortly after Suarez was substituted, he now looks a little bit like the player that Barcelona let go. And I thought, that's pretty harsh because he's had a great season. But not unfair based on that performance. And so I think maybe this is an instance of him suffering, Joao Felix, that is, suffering because of his surroundings. But as a spectacle and as someone that you can look at and imagine, God, think about where he'll be in 2 or 3 years when this piece is around him, when he's developed a proper chemistry with a, I don't know, another centre forward who is at a, you know, an equivalent stage of his own career. A guy, this guy is phenomenal. Absolutely.
What
phenomenal.
I want to know though is he on the Mbappe Haaland level?
Well, I think he'll always be treated differently because there's a natural binary relationship between Mbappe and Haaland because of the position they play. Whereas João Félix will always drop into a slightly different category. It will be like saying, right. It will be a little bit like, not that they're stylistically similar, it will be a little bit like the Juan Riquelme conversation.
Right, right, right.
It will always be a kind of a slightly acquired taste, but as a footballer and as just an aesthetic, he's sensational.
Okay. Well, that's very exciting, isn't it? Listen, we'll be back after this to chat about some of the other Champions League games. And coming up is Premier League relegation and a trip to the continent.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Okay, we're back. And now let us begin by talking about Manchester City 2, AG 4, AG 0-0, Borussia Mönchengladbach. Now, Manchester City, of course, into the quarterfinals fairly easily, it should be said, across two legs. Gundogan scores again. 12 goals this season, twice his previous season record, which was a couple of years ago for City. And beyond that, he's only scored 3 at most in any other season. Alex, what is happening?
Consistent run of games probably helps. I mean, he's not had the easiest time at City with injuries and absences and so on. But also, I think this ability that City have found of late in the absence of a genuine striker to encourage these late runs into the box from everybody, really. You know, City are playing with such a superb fluidity. You know, I think Cancelo is probably the most extreme example of this ability to get players into weird positions doing strange things. But Gundogan clearly has been tasked with not only sitting back and shoring up the midfield and spraying passes around, but being the guy who sneaks in at the end of moves without anybody noticing him.
Because it's the ones he doesn't score as well, right? It's not like 12 goals, fantastic return for a player in his position. But I frequently notice him when I watch City in sort of chance creation areas.
Oh, completely.
Like he misses more than he scores still, I think. He could have 20.
Yeah, and he does, you know, it's that... He's not like Lampard at Chelsea in that season when Lampard... Did Lampard actually score 20 goals? I think it possibly was that many.
Yeah.
But it's that same sort of thing of having a player who Lampard, I feel, was maybe more dynamic in it and arrived in the box with a bit more pace. Gundogan has a subtlety to him. He just, I don't want to say magically appears because that's a really stupid thing to say, but he's there and nobody has noticed his arrival. And maybe it is because he's a less physically imposing presence. And also because City can create this whirlwind of movement, and particularly with players like Bernardo Silva in that midfield line as well. Opposition defenders know that the quick runs and the quick interplay are coming from people like Bernardo Silva or Riyad Mahrez cutting in from the right-hand side or De Bruyne dropping off. And Gundogan benefits almost from being the guy that nobody really notices because he's not as jazzy as the other ones. And yeah, his intelligence, his positional intelligence is what allows him to get into those spots. And like you say, he could have more goals if he was maybe a bit better at finishing.
De Bruyne in the false nine again, too. I suppose that could also be partly related to Gundogan's recent performances and the desire to get silver in the 11, Alex.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, it goes back to this this flexibility. Guardiola is adept and has consistently been adept at solving individual problems when they pop up and thinking about the game very much as, you know, an ability to maximise what his side does. I think he's trying to figure out, or has, I think he's succeeded in this, how to play without Aguero for a large part of the season. And that has been to create this constant movement between the various midfield positions. And we say that De Bruyne is a false nine, and when City line up out of possession, that is nominally his position in the kind of first line of defence. But ultimately, all of these City players can pop up anywhere on the pitch and do pretty much whatever they want. And I say that not like it's chaotic. You know, there is structure and players are moving in relation to other players. But De Bruyne as a false nine is slightly misleading because it is a lot to do with the out of possession shape. The rest of the time, there's real freedom. Players are popping up in the centre forward position, dropping off. And this, yeah, like you say, this is part of why Gundogan has excelled this season. But it's also testament to the fact that Guardiola's really nailed it.
Yeah, okay. Well done. Back pats all round. What a surprise. Real Madrid, 3, aggregate 4. Aggregate 1, 1, Atalanta. Comfortable victory, another comfortable victory. Tuesday night, a night of comfortable victories for Madrid, who had clearly kicked it up a notch, Seb, from their last rather stolid performance in the first leg.
Yeah, goodness, that was an awful game over in Italy, wasn't it? Absolutely dreadful. It was. I remember the WhatsApp chat from that evening, and it wasn't a pretty sight. This was actually, you know what? For an hour, I really didn't enjoy this so much so that I ended up just getting to bed with my iPad. And then when Atlanta scored their weird free kick, I woke up my wife by kind of laughing about it. And funny enough, because we're now in Germany, my wife has kind of reverted back to instinctively talking German. So she woke up in a start and just started talking loud German at me. And I've only been learning for about 3 weeks. And that's quite intimidating when you're kind of...
How many words did you pick up? Prick, shut the fuck up. Did you get that?
It was more just the tone than the words rather than what they actually meant.
Sure.
The meaning behind them.
Was it Schließen dein Mund or something?
It was probably something of that nature, yeah. Wasn't happy. Mm-hmm. She wasn't happy. What I was going to say, though, is have you two seen the free kick?
Yeah.
So it's fun.
Well, let me describe
okay, you go first.
But before you get ahead of yourself, Seb, yeah?
Okay.
I've called it the double wall. Does that seem? That seems fair. Double ball. So Atalanta's got this. Came from a free kick scored by Muriel, during which they formed a three-man wall just ahead of the ball, facing the goal. And when the whistle blew, the blue wall of Atalanta charged at Real Madrid's wall and the draft excluder. And it kind of worked, I guess, because the goal was scored.
See, I don't agree, and this is why I laughed. This is why Jalen had a broken night's sleep, because... If you were Thibaut Courtois in that situation, are you distracted by anything that happens there, or are you just thinking, okay? Because your view of the ball isn't obstructed at any point.
No.
You just wait until the free kick is actually taken, and that's a really good free kick anyway. And it goes in the
top
corner.
But the defender's view of the ball is obstructed, right?
The defenders just jump straight up anyway.
Because they can't like angle their body to block. Because they don't know where the ball is.
I think that's a reach.
I think
there was a good intention behind the free kick's design. I just feel that it wasn't properly timed, or because the tie was out of reach, everyone sort of had a kind of fuck it attitude towards it.
I think it was a great free kick that people will wrongly conflate with what Atalanta did by running it. The Real Madrid wall, but I think it would have been a goal.
It was fun. It was fun. But that.
You guys are so depressing. Well, come on. It was exactly
I love a good free
Me
kick
too.
When it works, but that wasn't the point.
No, I disagree. I think it did work. I think defenders in walls can see the shape of a player. I think micro adjustments and movements can be made as a result of body language. I think if I think also just having something confusing happening in front of you can make a big difference to your ability to impact the situation. And I think it would be impossible for either of you to say for sure that it didn't make any difference, that it didn't impact the goal. Because I think if it did make a difference, then, as you said, it's kind of marginal. It's a small difference, right? But sometimes that's all that's needed. Is somebody going to ring your doorbell every single time we record a podcast, Alex?
I was just wondering this, that.
Jesus Christ. Do you know what it is? It's probably the postman who's come and brought you a letter from your grandparents who are telling you to not be so cynical about it.
Do you want me to go and get it?
I will fight our corner.
I want to know what it is.
On this free kick issue.
Go and get it. No, there's no need. There's no corner to fight.
No,
what I'm telling you is that you couldn't possibly say for sure that it didn't have any impact. So I reject that, right? And we will leave this in the area where it could have, or it maybe it didn't, maybe it did. But who could possibly ever say? Not you, sir.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's the little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms or restrictions apply.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Are you saying they couldn't have got to it?
I'm saying they might have done, but I don't think whether they would or wouldn't was, in that case, impacted by anything that the Atlanta players did around the ball before it was...
Are we still talking about the free kick?
You're just
damn right. Yeah,
I told you
I was going to fight our corner.
You can't know that. Like unless you're saying that the defenders couldn't categorically get to that ball, which is not true, right?
I'm not
then
saying that.
You cannot say that it didn't have any impact.
Isn't that
the point though? No one can know either way for sure. But because it was a great free kick, that's what I'm saying.
That's why I'm saying you're both wrong for saying that it didn't have any impact because you can't know for sure.
No, what I'm saying is that people will view it as having an outsized impact because of the result.
I'm saying it had no impact. I am being categoric about it.
Okay. We've got three separate positions. I can. No, you can't.
I'm not sure you can. I don't think you can.
It's like he's digging his heels in. It's like wrapping up a present in wrapping paper, but then not using any sellotape. You give it to someone, it all falls off. It's decoration, it has no purpose, it doesn't create any delays or distractions. It's just the gift is the same, the box is the same.
Is wrapping paper supposed to be a distraction?
That was a break. This is a podcast. It's the Premier League. And I thought it'd be a good time to talk about this because reason number one, I'm not here next week. Reason number two, it's an international break the weekend after this one. So we've got a bit of a gap before the Premier League resolves itself. 10 games left for most teams. And what I've done here is I've taken the future fixtures and collated them for Fulham, Newcastle and Brighton. I did think about including Burnley, but they look a little far off. I did think about including West Brom, and then I saw how many points they actually have and decided, no, that would be foolish. They are clearly relegated already. So I'm going to begin by telling you the points and the number of games played. This may change if you're listening to this podcast after the weekend. A couple of these teams are playing at the weekend, I believe. Fulham, 26 points, 29 games played. Newcastle, 28 points, 28 games played. Brighton, 29 points, 28 games played. So Fulham, I guess, are in the worst position at the moment, also with a game more played than the two teams that they are chasing, and a point or two fewer. So they have the most ground to make up. And we begin with Fulham by saying that their fixtures are as follows. Home games versus Leeds, Wolves, Burnley, and Newcastle on the last day of the season, which could be absolutely fucking massive. I'm very excited about that.
Also fans potentially in that game.
Also fans potentially, which would be great. Away games, here's where it gets a little tougher. I think I've made a mistake here by saying that they're away to Fulham.
Possibly you've made a mistake.
I think that might be a mistake, unless, you know, something weird's happened. Away games, and this is where it gets a little bit harder. Villa, Arsenal, Southampton, Chelsea, Manchester United. Seb, I know that you are hopeful for Fulham, or at least you're expectant. You believe that they will have an opportunity to stay up. One game fewer left to play than the two teams that they are chasing, 2 and 3 points respectively less. Those are some really difficult away fixtures, and there's five of them before the end of the season.
Yeah, but I don't see any of the teams in that area picking up lots and lots of points. So I think as long as you remain, if you're Fulham, as long as you remain within touching distance of Newcastle, which is very possible because Newcastle can't win football games at the moment, then you're going to go into that game on the last game of the season. And you would, at the moment, unless something very dramatic changes at Newcastle, you would certainly fancy Fulham. And like we said in our last pod, you would always put your money on the happier group of players. And with Steve Bruce investigates going on at Newcastle and Matt Ritchie doing whatever, you know, it's Fulham, isn't it? And yes, I want them to survive because I admire Scott Parker's work, and also I'd like to see what he'd be able to do with a second season in the Premier League, with a summer of spending and with a bit of squad refinement. I think that'd be very, very interesting. Newcastle I don't care about because Newcastle will be exactly the same next season as they have been for pretty much a decade. It will just be the same old struggle, and the kind of we'll get to this point of the year and oh, Ashley hasn't spent any money again, and now what are we going to do? Should we get rid of Steve Bruce and bring in, you know, Mike Walker? I don't know. So I'm not really that interested in Newcastle as a spectacle. I have endless sympathy for what's happening at the club and the town and the region and the way the supporters have been treated. But do I want to go through another chapter of this story? No, because I've read it so many times before.
Well, let's do Newcastle then, since we're talking about them.
Yeah.
10 games left to play. Home games include Spurs, West Ham, Arsenal, Man City, Sheffield United. That's hard. Away games, Brighton, Burnley, Liverpool, Leicester, and of course away to Fulham on the last day of the season. Also really tough games.
That's a horrible set of fixtures for Newcastle, particularly when the home games, obviously they're not going to beat Man City, they probably won't beat Arsenal, but Spurs and West Ham as well will frustrate them, be incredibly hard to break down and then pick them off on the break, which really doesn't suit Newcastle's style of play. And then they're away at two of their relegation rivals.
And I think Liverpool and Leicester.
Yeah. And again, you know, Brighton, I know we'll come on to talk about Brighton, but Brighton and Fulham both look like teams with a coherent plan that have, you know, Brighton got a good result away against Southampton. I know we're a bit on the slide at the moment, but that was a very competent performance and a merited victory. And they are the sides that look to have a greater degree of momentum. And if Newcastle, you know, don't take points off at least one of them, it does start to look very, very difficult, especially given that Newcastle will then have a bit of a tailspin because the pressure gets heaped further and further on. If you're not beating your relegation rivals, then everything else seems that much harder. And as Seb says, the morale in that camp has got to be as low as it always consistently seems to be. So Yeah, it doesn't look good for them.
Well, Brighton also, 29 points, 9 games left to play. Newcastle, Everton, Leeds and Man City at home. And away, Man United, Chelsea, Sheffield United, Wolves and Arsenal. Which is also not an easy set of fixtures. I'm thinking particularly, you know, Everton. I mean, Leeds are a difficult... it's difficult to know what's going to happen in any game against Leeds. But the Newcastle tie at home obviously is going to be complicated. Everton have had a fantastic season. Manchester City are obviously blowing absolutely everybody away and don't appear to want to slow down. Manchester United away is probably better than Manchester United at home because they're shit at Old Trafford, so maybe you'll get a result there. Chelsea, Sheffield United, Wolves, Arsenal. These are all difficult games in which to score. And I'm aware that Brighton's issue across the season has at times been scoring.
Yeah, although there are signs that that's starting to change. I thought they were oddly clinical at St Mary's over the weekend. And in many ways, they're kind of a more evolved version of Fulham. Like, given a couple of years and with a bit of investment in certain areas of the pitch, you can imagine Fulham looking a little bit more like Brighton. But Brighton just a little bit further down the track. And I know we talk about those difficult games and top four sides. I think a hidden factor in the end of this season is going to be that top four before much longer is going to be ironclad. I don't see it being very competitive. Maybe there'll be a bit of a ruck over the final fourth place. But generally speaking, I think the teams involved who are still occupied by European competition are going to start looking elsewhere. So if you think about Man United, we're recording this on the Thursday before United go to Milan, so we don't know if they've gone through yet. But if they do, then chances are they're going to have a top four place sewn up before much longer and are going to kind of be dedicating more resources towards continental competitions. And I don't know, on their day, Brighton don't have an inability to compete, and they aren't unable to cut teams open. They haven't been able to cut teams open and make that count for anything. But if that is starting to change, and I know like playing at Old Trafford or Stamford Bridge is a little bit different to St Mary's, but if there is an improvement, you could see them picking up points where perhaps Newcastle wouldn't or Fulham wouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that's why, like I know the league table says that we must be concerned for them, but it's why I've never really been that worried for them. Maybe it's based on the assumption that things are going to change and that, you know, chances are going to be converted. And that's maybe a little bit naive, but that seems to be stacking up. They seem to be progressing forward a little bit at the moment.
Uh-huh. Well, speaking of naive, let's look back at the predictions we made for this Premier League season, because you sound very confident there, right? And that's fantastic. I like your confidence, Seb. I really do, because it helps me enjoy what's about to happen more. At the beginning of the season, for those of you who don't know, we all made our we predicted the full Premier League table and its lineup by the end of the season. Now, of course, we weren't expecting to get 100%, but some of us have done better than others. That's all. Some of us have done better than others. And Seb, would you like me to remind you of your order of events, because you've done pretty well in some areas? You said Manchester City would be top currently. You're correct. That's exciting, isn't it? You also were the only person to have Manchester United in your top three. And given that they are second in the league, I think that's a great success too. You did have Leicester down at eighth, which I think looks a little unfair for their performances this season. How could you? You also had Tottenham at fifth, which is, you know, quite funny because they're shit.
Optimistic, yeah.
Also Arsenal at sixth, which I understand why you would put them there, but of course they are currently 10th. Looking at other things, Everton have done a lot better than you said they would. Wolves have done a lot worse than you said they would. Sheffield United, you put at 10th. Of course, we know the story there. Newcastle, you've given a little too much credit, I believe. Burnley, you're very on the button. Brighton, Leeds, you haven't given enough credit to. But of course, there are two here that are a little... a little unfortunate. Aston Villa, you had just avoiding relegation in 17th place. Of course, they've surprised many people, including you, by being currently in the top half of the table at the moment, already on 41 points. And would you like to remind listeners who you had at the bottom, the 20th position in the table?
West Ham.
You had West Ham United. at the very foot of the Premier League table, and they are currently fifth. I think what I like to do is a differential, a numerical differential at the end of the season to see who actually has the best score. And what's really going to delight me, I think also Alex may have had West Ham in the relegation zone too. There's such a gap between your predicted positions and the reality there that I feel pretty confident about winning. Now, Alex, if you thought you were going to escape, you were wrong. Manchester City, you had in
at
first.
At no point did I think that I would escape, that you would pass up the opportunity to do this.
Thing is, everyone's got Liverpool in their sort of top three, and that's a real surprise. You had Man City top, fantastic. Chelsea in third, which they may well be by the end of the season, who knows. Man United fourth, okay. You gave Leicester City the credit they deserved by putting them above Arsenal and Tottenham, and you actually have Tottenham in eighth, bang on, so congratulations. And Everton in seventh, bang on. That's really good work. Wolves far too high, Burnley far too high, Saints maybe by the end of the season, Sheffield United of course completely wrong, Palace and Leeds and Newcastle and Brighton and Villa again in 17th. Again, I think, you know, Villa in 9th really surprised some people. So you've done better than Seb so far. However, you did also put West Ham United not quite foot of the table, but you put them 19th place. Yeah. So would you like to apologise to West Ham?
Where did you put West Ham, Joe?
Where did I put West Ham? Put West Ham not being relegated. And I
right, where did you put them, Joe?
Well, I just put them at not being relegated. So just you let put them, you know I was correct.
You put them in 17th and you put Villa in 16th.
Yes, but I said neither of those teams would get relegated and neither of them.
And who did you have winning, Joe?
Liverpool. Had Liverpool winning.
Okay. Yeah. And where did you have City, Joe?
Third place.
Okay. Yeah. No, so it's going really well for
Chelsea
you.
In second. It's going very well. I had Tottenham in sixth. That's pretty close. Leicester in seventh. Very close. Arsenal in fifth. Very, very close.
Very kind to Southampton.
Very kind to Southampton. Leeds, Burnley, very kind. Palace, Newcastle, Villa. Oh, pretty kind, I would say. I'm fairly certain that, Alex, let's just agree that Seb is doing worst at the moment.
I think we can agree on that, Joe.
The accredited football journalist is
happy.
Doing the
happy
worst
to go with that.
So far. Anyway, the accredited football journalist wants to talk about football, I think. So it says here in the plan,
Yeah, this someone's butchered the plan by mistake.
Yeah, I think Seb's random highlighting has somehow managed to copy loads of Chelsea chat into the Torino Sassuolo plan. I've no idea what that is now, Seb. I think you might need to explain it to me.
No, it's perfectly intended. It was I just wanted to make it completely inaccessible to either of you two so that I could have a little monologue at the end of the pod.
Go on, monologue.
Okay, so sneaky good game in the middle of a weekday afternoon, Torino Sassuolo. Interesting to us because it involved a theme that we've been talking about a lot, which is Tottenham's negativity under Jose Mourinho. And in this game, Sassuolo went 2-0 up, two really nice Berardi goals. And then from that point, I don't really know what, because Torino started chucking on forwards and started playing far more aggressively. And as the second half wore on, obviously Sassuolo got their counter-attacking chances as a result. And every time they got one, every time they found themselves in a 2-on-2 or a 3-on-3, they would back off from taking the chance and just consolidate possession and then settle back into their defensive shape, bounce the ball between their centre halves a little bit, and then surrender possession. And as time wore on, the pressure grew, the momentum grew against them so much that I think by the end of the game, Torino had probably four forwards on. One of them was Simone Zaza, ex-West Ham legend, and he completed the comeback in stoppage time, and Torino won 3-2, which is just really interesting because I think, go and find the highlights if you haven't seen them, but also it's weird that football teams can put themselves in a situation where they kind of invite a self-fulfilling prophecy. So you play really well, you play really smartly to get yourself to a two-goal advantage away from home. And then to consolidate that position, you abandon everything that's taken you to that. It's just a really weird, it's almost like a mental tick. And everybody who was watching could see it coming a mile away. Even I was listening to it on The Zone while I was doing my work, and I was kind of glancing at it, but I could hear the commentary. And the commentator kept saying things like, well, there's only 4 minutes left, but you bet on Torino getting a draw from here. And it was like, well, I don't know, mate. They haven't hit the target for about half an hour. And it just felt inevitable. It was such a self-sabotage that it kind of stayed with me. It was great fun to watch, and some of the goals were really nice, especially the plunging header at the death. But it's just a very strange way to approach a winning position. Yeah, it's just odd. Monologue over.
Okay, well, can we restart the monologue but make it about Mikel Antonio choosing Jamaica, please?
Yeah, we can do. And you made me close the Google Docs, which has all of this information on it. So I'm
what a shame. I can tell you that the president of the country's FA, Michael Ricketts, has plans to recruit all sorts of other players, including Mason Holgate, Isaac Hayden, Nathan Redmond, Kamar Roof, Ivan Toney, Andre Gray, and Max Ahrens, of course, as well.
Yeah, so...
He was approached by the Jamaican FA last month, Mikel Antonio. He was born in England, but his parents were born in Jamaica.
Yeah, the Michael Ricketts mentioned is not the ex-Bolton forward who had a solitary England cap. It's a different Michael Ricketts. But Jamaica has been on the hunt for English-based players with Jamaican heritage who might be interested in representing the country internationally. And Antonio is the names on that list don't wholly surprise me. If they want to play international football, then that seems like a really good move. And, if a player feels an attachment to a nation, then fantastic. If they were born there, obviously, or if their parents were born there, that's, it's not an uncommon situation.
Or TBF, if they just want to play international football, that's cool too. I don't think they have to feel an attachment to the nation.
Yeah, yes and no, because yes, you may want to play international football, but if you want to play international football for Jamaica, that means a lot of traveling, a lot of jet lag, a lot of pressure put on your domestic form probably. And so you almost certainly will have some kind of attachment. It's got to be an emotional draw as well as just I want to play international football. I accept that does happen in certain situations, but probably not in this one. Antonio's a standout in that list because, well, he's probably the best player amongst that group, but also because it just feels as if it's a classic England situation. I think for a long time he did want to play for England, and he was actually called up for a squad without getting a cap. And you just think it's one of those situations where it's like an odd fitting player, because Mikel Antonio, as we've talked about before, isn't a kind of a regular shaped player. He doesn't belong in a specific position. He is not a typical centre forward, winger, fullback, whatever.
He belongs in a major tournament though.
He does.
I honestly feel like he could be like the golden boot winner at the Euros if England took him. Do you know what I mean? If it worked out in one way.
Well, Joe, I think it's even simpler than that. If you were a centre back, would you want to play against Antonio? He'd be a nightmare. Like, he does everything well. He's unorthodox, meaning he's unpredictable, and he changes games. Okay, he's not the smoothest player, and he's not, he's not blessed with kind of velvet skill or anything like that, but he's incredibly effective. And a lot of what he does to a really high standard. And you just think, this is England thinking, yeah, don't really know what to do with him. And he doesn't really fit in our formation, so he doesn't pique our interest. And I just find that quite sad, I think. And it just feels a little bit typical. Well, yeah, because in the same way that I'm sure there's somebody out there, speculating about, why don't we take Andy Carroll to the European Championship? Because he does something different.
It's
having the
man.
Same fucking argument again and again. And yet, unless it's that only ever applies to really tall players who are good in the air. So for Andy Carroll, see Peter Crouch. Like, Peter Crouch a better player than Andy Carroll. But it's the same principle. And with Antonio, I don't know, it just seems like a lack of effort to see where the value might be in him for England. And it's frustrating.
Yeah, if I was the manager, I would take him with me to the Euros. I don't know who I'd take him in place of, but I'd definitely take him. I think he just offers something that's completely different to all of the other strikers. Anyway, there's also the Liga Communique.
Yeah, this is a story which has been developing in France, and it began with individual clubs saying that they wouldn't release players who were due to play international fixtures outside of Europe during the March international break that we're just coming up to.
Yeah, get them.
Well, by the end of yesterday, it had become league-wide. So it's a central directive, which is, I don't really know what's going to happen from here, but it's interesting because I can completely understand it. But then there are World Cup qualifiers to be played as well. It's not just friendlies for every team. So I don't know. I don't know how you respond to that if you're FIFA or if you're one of the kind of the regional governing bodies. I'm not sure what happens. I think you can punish a club or a number of clubs for failing to release players. I don't think you can compel them to release them. I don't think the mechanism exists to do that. It's just a kind of an agreement that, you know, that clubs and nations cooperate. So I don't know the procedure. But it's interesting. It's something to watch out for.
Yeah, well, maybe we can bring some updates of that in the coming weeks. Anyway, before we finish, it's time for Joe's Player Quotes and Facts database. It's Joe's Quotes and Facts database. Only one addition to the database today, and it's a Chelsea player, Hakim Ziyech. It's also quite a sentimental addition. I didn't realise any of this before when I was looking this morning. I was looking for something funny, as usual, something I could say in a funny way. But this isn't that. This is something from Hakim Ziyech's childhood. He has eight siblings. Did you know that? Eight siblings. There's nine of them, the Ziyech children. Lost his father at 10 years old, after which his mother raised the nine children on her own. Fuck me. That is
well done, Mrs. Ziyech.
I know, this is the thing. Ziyech's quote, Hakim Ziyech's quote is, "If it wasn't for her, I'd have quit football a long time ago." I thought that was just a nice addition. A week after Mother's Day that I forgot. Oh, dear. Whoops. Anyway, Hakim Ziyech, well done, Mrs. Ziyech, if that indeed is your name. A delayed Mother's Day special, Joe's Player Quotes and Facts list. Of course, my mother didn't raise nine children, so I don't know what the fuck she's complaining about. But, you know.
We're all so, so sorry, Mrs. Devine.
She does listen to the podcast.
So sorry.
Yeah. But there you go, Mrs. Ziyech. Well done to Mrs. or Ms. Ziyech. And indeed to Hakim Ziyech, who, you know, is a successful footballer now. And I'm sure takes care of the famo. Right, that is the end of today's podcast. I won't be here next week because I am on holiday. What am I doing? Nothing. Just going to sit at the same desk and probably use the same computer to do slightly different things. Maybe I'll play some Rocket League. Very exciting. But for now, Alex Stewart, thank you.
Thank you, Joe.
Herr Steb Seppelblor, Dankeschön.
Dankeschön. Thank you, Joe.
And Alex and Seb will be back twice next week on Tuesday and Friday with some, I'm sure very exciting morsels of...
Real privilege to have Ian Hume on to talk about his head injury from back in 2008. Learned so much from talking to him, and he was very generous with his time. So I think we're going to run that next Friday, so a week today.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's very exciting. I hope everybody enjoys the international break that's going to happen next weekend. We'll talk about that when I'm back. Anyway, for now, thanks to producer Adonis, as always, and au revoir, listeners. Tipos!
The Athletic.